and he digs his heels in harder, grinding my hips against the wood. He leans over me. Turning his ugly, scaled face to the side, he fixes me with a cold stare. His glassy eyes are reptilian, a vertical strip of black slicing through the blue-gray. There's a streak of pink as his tongue darts out to taste my skin. He spits. Disgusting. The stink of the herb shop is all over you. His leer rolls down my body, slowly, creeping. Perhaps you need a good licking to clean it off. Panic flares inside me like a firecracker, bright and burning, a sudden flare. You wouldn't, I stammer. I'm a paper girl. So you'll admit it now. Sith laughs, cutting me off. Well, you know exactly what is expected of you then. Better start practicing. He runs a hand along my shoulder and tugs my shirt back. Rough fingers brush down my arm, sending a wave of nausea into my throat. I squirm away, buck my hips, trying to throw him off, but my struggling barely moves him. So, I scream. Sith clamps a hand over my mouth. Quiet, he hisses. Not a sound or... Get off her. The command is delivered quietly, yet firm as a fist. At once, Sith lurches off me. General Yu stands framed in the doorway, one hand resting on the hilt of the sword at his belt. Sith points at me. The girl tried to escape, General. He starts, and I'm glad to see a tremor in his outstretched finger. She's fast. But I caught her and brought her straight back. I was just keeping her here until your return. Liar, I snarl. The general regards us in silence, his face impassive. The boat is ready to set sail, he says, turning. Follow me. I sense Sith relax. Yes, General. But Sith? The general pauses, continuing over his shoulder. If I ever catch you touching the girl inappropriately again, it will be your job to explain to the king how you soiled one of his concubines. Do you understand? Sith flinches. Yes, General. This time when he grabs me, Sith takes care to keep to where my shoulders are covered. But he marches me forward with the same aggression and shoots me a sideways look. Slatted eyes narrowed in disgust. I scowl openly back, but I don't struggle. His grip is tight, and ahead of us, the general's fist is still around the hilt of his sword, reminding me how easily he would be able to turn it against me. We follow General Yu in the opposite direction to which I ran, out to the ocean front. There's a port, busy even at this hour. Lights glint from the wooden gantries, rippling the water with color. A wide, star-speckled sky stretches out to an invisible horizon. Despite everything that's going on, my eyes open wide at the sight. I've always dreamed about seeing the sea. Behind us, restaurants and hookah cafes line the street, the night filled with raucous laughter, the jeers and yells of an argument bursting into life. Wherever we are, it doesn't seem like a rich town. There are only a few demon figures among the crowds, and all of them are steel. Outside one of the shops, a salt-stained banner snaps in the wind. I make out the faded pattern of two rearing canines, back to back, painted in sweeping brushstrokes across the fabric. The famous dog clan of Noé, the black jackals. I do a double take. Noé? Louder, I call ahead to General Yu. We're in Noé? He doesn't turn, but his head tilts, which I take as a yes. My mouth goes dry. Noé is the province to the east of Cienzo. We've traveled farther than I hoped. As the general leads us to the far side of the port, we pass young ship hands dressed in grubby sarongs and fishermen deftly picking squid from clouds of tangled nets. We come to a stop at a large boat moored at the end of a dock. A crowd of fin-shaped cream sails, unfurled, flutter in the wind. The tiger soldier is waiting at the top of the gangplank.
The captain is ready to set sail, General, he says with a tuck of his chin.
Good. Sith, take the girl to her room.
Yes, General.
And remember what I said. As soon as he turns away, Sith scowls. He lowers his mouth close to my cheek, and I stare ahead with my lips pressed, holding down a shiver as his words unspool silkily in my ear.
You're welcome to try to escape again, pretty girl. But this time, it will be the sea's arms waiting to catch you. And I think you'll find them an even crueler embrace than mine.
4. No one tells me how long we'll be sailing for. I watch for differences in the ocean, scan the horizon for signs of land, any opportunity for escape. But after 3 days, the rolling slate blue of the sea still looks identical. And besides, most of the time, I'm crouched with my head over a bucket, watching another kind of liquid slop back and forth. I'm so seasick, I barely have the energy to worry about what will happen when we arrive at our destination. Resignation is beginning to settle in my bones like a poison, black and slow. There is no going back now. I'm ready for whatever is coming my way, I tell myself, so many times that I wonder who I'm trying to convince. 2 times a day, the general sends a ship hand to bring me food. After I throw up the steamed taro dumplings he serves me one night, the boy sneaks back with a second helping. He's a moon cast, fox form, probably just a couple of years younger than me. Maybe it's because of his age, or how he can barely look me in the eye, but for whatever reason, it's the first time I haven't been completely intimidated by a moon demon. Over the days, I've come to appreciate the lovely umber hue of his fur. How there's something beautiful about the way his jaw is molded, a hard curve tapering to a sharp chin. Wait, I say now as he hurries to leave. I don't dare touch the bamboo basket, even though the smell of the dumplings inside makes my mouth water. The fox boy stops in the doorway. The white tip of his tail gives a small flick.
It's just, they'll notice, I continue, that some food is missing.
He hesitates. Then he says jerkily,
it's my portion.
This simple act, the kindness of it, surprises me so much, especially coming from a moon cast. Willowy vulpine haunches showing beneath his worker's sarong, that I just blurt straight out, why? Looking over his shoulder, he doesn't quite meet my eyes.
Why what?
Why help me? I'm paper.
The fox boy turns back to the door.
So?
He answers.
You need the help more than anyone.
I blink, glad that he's gone before he can see how much his comment has stung. I consider not eating the dumplings out of principle. Who needs pity dumplings anyway? But I'm too weary to hold out for long.
Still, his words stay with me. It makes me recall something Mama once told me, when I'd come back from a trip with my father to a neighboring town to collect a batch of rare herbs. A fat man threw his banana skin at us, I told her when we arrived home, indignant, my eyes puffy from crying. My mother had shared a look with my father before crouching down in front of me, hands cupping my wet cheeks.
"Oh, darling,"
she said before asking me calmly, "do you know why?" I sniffed, my little fists bunched. "He told us we shouldn't be in the same shop as Steels or Moons." "He was a demon?" I pouted. "A fat, ugly dog one." Behind me, Baba snorted, falling quiet quickly at the look my mother gave him. "Would you like to know a secret?" she said, pulling me closer and tucking a stray lock of hair behind my ears. "A secret so secret, not even those who know it are always aware?" I nodded. Mama smiled. "Well, despite what they look like, all demons have the same blood as us. Yes, even fat, ugly dog ones. If the gods gave birth to us, why should we be any different? We are all the same, really, little one, deep down. So don't you worry about what the silly man said." And 6-year-old me had nodded, believing her, trusting in the certainty of her words, even if the world was trying to prove me otherwise. Then, a year later, the claws and fire, the crush and cries. We might be the same deep down, paper, steel, and moon, but it didn't matter then. I rub my arms over my pale, leaf-thin skin, and it doesn't matter now. On the morning of the fifth day at sea, shouts ring out from the deck. Though the words are muffled, stolen by the wind, one reaches me. It flies into my heart on wings both shadowed with fear and bright with relief. Han, the Royal Province. We've arrived. I scramble to the window. At first I can't see anything, but after a minute, the shape of the coast reveals itself, the city nestled in the bay, growing clearer as we approach. The Black Port, Han's famous port city. The dark rock of the surrounding cliffs are what gave it its name, and under the glare of the sun, the stone has a sheen to it, making it look almost wet. But what strikes me more is the size of the city. It's bigger than I could possibly have imagined, dense and sprawling, carving a deep line along the coast and backing into the mountainous terrain. Tiers of wooden houses stretch for miles. Their dark walls are stained from the salt-rich air, and their roofs curl upward at the edges, like paper that has started to burn. Mirroring the city, the harbor in front is just as crowded. Thousands of boats cluster in the water, from small fishing tugs with multicolored sails, to papaya-shaped boats laden with fruits, to round barrel-like water taxis all in a line, waiting to ferry passengers along the bay, and elegant ships decorated with silk ribbons. We weave through them, drawing close enough to some to make out the individual patterns of their sails, the names scrawled on their sides. There are good fortune characters, clan insignias, coal black bull skulls stamped on the scarlet sails of towering military ships. "You're alive, then. We thought you were so sick you might vomit up your own soul." I pivot round to see General Yu in the doorway. I give him a scowl. At least I have a soul. Before I can speak, he waves a hand, already turning. "Come." When we emerge onto the deck, half a minute later, my hand flies to shade my eyes. After so long inside, the openness of the sky and sea all around stuns me. Everything is luminous, sun-glazed. As my eyes adjust, I make out our surroundings, from the gaudy colored sails of the ship docked beside us to the spotted bellies of gulls swooping overhead. The dock is alive with movement. Every gangway, airwalk, bridge, and boat deck swarms with hurrying figures. Unlike the port in Noe, there are far more demons here, more so than humans, an indication of the province's affluence and power. I swallow. The sight of so many steel and moon casts is an unwelcome reminder of where I am, who I am. I hug my arms around myself, feeling exposed in my tatty clothes. "General," Sith announces, appearing at the top of the gangplank. "The carriage is ready." As he bows, his eyes lift and find me. A smirk plays across his thin lips. Something hot sparks in my chest as I remember his scaled fingers on me. Glaring, I jut my chin. "Hurry up, girl," General Yu growls, shoving me forward. As we make our way down toward the waiting carriage, the fierce sun pricking sweat under my arms, I scan the teeming dock for escape routes. But it's broad daylight, in the middle of the busiest port in Ikara. If I run, I won't get far. And besides, the general's heavy hooffall beside me is reminder enough that I have to be obedient. Sith comes up behind me to my other side, a fraction too close. "Need a hand, pretty girl?" I jerk away before he can touch me. "Never from you." Well, obedient doesn't have to mean cowering. Tian's proud face flashes into my mind. "Wow, little nuisance. Look at you, standing up to a demon like your skin is moon and not paper." The thought brings a sad, defiant smile to my lips. I blow out a breath. Then, rolling my shoulders back, I take the last few steps to the carriage, my chin high. Because if this is to be my fate, I'm going to walk boldly into it on my own 2 feet. Without any demon claws dragging me forward. Outside the port city, our carriage joins a long road winding through the flatland behind the mountains. It's filled with strange rock formations, scraggly pines, and tiny white wildflowers clinging to their faces. The dry ground is covered in red dust. The air is thick with it too. Coppery clouds kicked up by the horses. Even though the shutters are pulled down and the covering is drawn tightly across the entranceway, the dust still finds its way inside the carriage, coating my skin in a light layer. I lick my lips. The dust tastes like how it looks, of rust and dirt and endings. All around us, the thoroughfare is a chaotic whirl of activity. There are men on bear and horseback, carts pulled by tusk boars, huge ground ships with their sails spread wide. While the busyness makes me shrink farther back from the window, General Yu seems buoyed by the energy and noise, and he leans over to my side, pointing out the crests of notable clans. "See there? The green and white flag? That's Kutori's reptilian clan, the Cho. Exquisite clothes makers. Even the king has their fabrics imported. And there, that chain of ground boats belongs to the Feng Shi, very powerful family from Shomu province. An ornate gilded carriage pulls into pace alongside us, and the general notes the insignia.
Ah, the White Wing Clan.
One of the most powerful bird families in Nikara.
Surely even you must have heard of them.
I don't give him the satisfaction of admitting I haven't. Velvet curtains are draped across the carriage windows. I'm just turning away when one of the curtains twitches aside, and my gaze locks with the glossy eyes of a swan form girl. The white feathers covering her skin are so lustrous that it's as though they were powdered in pearl dust. She's so beautiful that I instinctively smile, but the girl doesn't return it. A feather-clad hand touches her shoulder, and she releases the curtain, disappearing behind the smooth gold.
Filthy felines,
comes a growl from the general. I glance round, confused, but he's staring in the opposite direction, his lip furled. Beyond the other window, a sleek ground ship is passing by. Marigold sails billow in a presumably magic-enhanced wind. Craning my head to look out, I track the figures stalking the deck. The way they move reminds me of Tien's feline slink, and beneath the cloths wrapped over their mouths, I make out the jut of their maws. Cat forms. My eyes flick to the sails. Each is stamped with three claw-tipped paw prints. Our carriage gives a kick, hitting a pothole in the road just as I place the crest. The Amala, or the Cat Clan, as they're more affectionately known. My father has told me stories about them, not even trying to hide the note of admiration in his voice. Out of all demon clans, the Cat Clan is the one paper castes feel most affinity for. They're known for their rebellious nature, uprising, and causing trouble wherever they can, especially if it involves annoying the king.
I heard they intercepted a wagon carrying crates of the king's pastries from a specialist bakery in Anken.
Baba told me just a few weeks ago, a glimmer in his eyes.
When it arrived at the hidden palace, they found that a single bite had been taken out of each of the pastries. Every one.
I pushed down a snigger at the memory. Now these are demons I can get behind. As we watch, two men on horseback ride up beside the Amala's groundship. Wind billows their long, peacock blue capes, so I can't make out the white brushstrokes that would reveal their clan. But there's something about the elegant manner in which the men ride that invokes royalty. Even though, of course, they can't be. They're human. One of the Amala's members leans over the edge of the ship, shouting something to the two men, gesturing wildly. They shout back, or at least they seem to from the movement of their heads, before pulling their horses away.
Who were they?
I ask as the men disappear into the lines of traffic. General Yu doesn't look round.
The Hanos, he answers distractedly.
Something flickers across his face, gone too quickly for me to interpret. I've heard of the Hanos from my father and Tien, though with none of the warmth in their voices as when they'd spoken of the Cat Clan. The largest paper caste clan in Nikara, the Hanos are one of the Demon King's most prominent supporters. When it comes to paper clans, one of his only supporters. So why were two of their men talking with one of the king's main opponents? We ride on, day slipping into night as a steady rain claims the land. Hour after hour, the number of travelers drops away. I stare out the window. A moonless sky hangs vast and heavy over the plains. The air is cool, and with the rain, the darkness is complete, viscous, like I could dive right into it. An image comes to me
of one of the sky gods. Soka, harbinger of night. How he'd extend his hand to catch me as I fell toward him. A grin of swallowed starlight widening across his face.
Eat, commands General Yu suddenly, snapping me from my dark imagining.
He hands me a leather flask and a package wrapped in a pandan leaf.
I don't want you fainting from hunger during your inspection at the palace.
I take a grateful bite of the fragrant, sticky rice inside, the spices warming my belly.
The magic on this carriage, I begin between chews.
I risk a glance at the general. Was it cast by the royal shamans?
Our little village girl has heard of them, huh?
Everyone in Nakara has heard of them. He grunts.
I suppose. But the way some people in the royal palace revere them, as if they are gods. Even the demon king himself acts as though their powers are holy, he adds with a snort.
My brow furrows at the general's dismissal. The royal shamans hold legendary status across Ikara. Like the paper girls, they're a feature of the hidden palace, whose mystery has been cloaked with layers of gossip and superstition. The story goes that when the demon king created the hidden palace, he ordered his architects to design an impenetrable fortress. His architects told him there could be no such thing, and so the king had them executed. Their replacements were more careful. After many discussions, they suggested a constant Tao to be woven into the perimeter wall. No single shaman could do this, but a group of them, constantly at work, might be capable. Shamans combining power isn't unheard of, but it's usually only a small group working on behalf of a clan or an army, a temporary arrangement. What the king's advisors suggested was a permanent one, a large group taking turns to craft the magic that would live within the palace walls.
Is it true there's over 1,000 shamans in the royal guard? I ask.
1,000? That is nothing, girl. There are many thousand.
Which is why I didn't understand.
The general stops abruptly. Didn't understand what? I prompt. With a jerky movement, he gestures to the scar splitting his face.
It would be an ugly face even without the scar. The wide, flat bull's nose. Too large between narrow cheekbones, the heavy-set lower jaw. But the scar twists it into a macabre mask, less demon than monster.
I received this recently in a battle in Janna, the general scowls, glaring stonily ahead. I asked the king's permission for one of the royal shamans to heal it, but he refused. He told me that battle scars are a badge of honor, of power. That to want to rid myself of one is a sign of weakness.
You can imagine the king's reaction when I pointed out that he himself has often used magic on his own scars.
A muscle twitches in his neck.
It's not often I am so foolish. I was lucky he only demoted me.
I get a sudden flare of empathy for General Yu, which disappears in an instant as he traces a calloused finger along my cheek.
That's where you come in.
I draw back. What do you mean?
It's true you are no classic beauty, he muses, looking over me. You lack the elegance of girls who have grown up in the affluent societal circles. And yet, those eyes. It might just be enough to stir the king's interest. He pauses, expression darkening. At least, let us hope so. The chosen girls will be arriving at the palace tonight. We'll have to be careful about how we approach Mistress Iara and Madame Himura about you.
I blink. The selection process is already over?
Weeks ago.
Then what am I here for?
My voice rises.
What happens if they don't want me?
I grip the edge of the bench, pitching forward.
If they don't, can I go back home?
Of course not, the general cuts in. And you will make sure they want you. I need to get back into the king's favor after the incident with my scar. Sith heard rumors of a human girl, with eyes the color of gold. But I didn't quite believe it until I saw you.
There's a challenge in his gaze.
Tell me, girl, do you have what it takes to win over the court?
Anger hardens inside me. So that's what he's bringing me to the palace for? A bargaining chip? I don't want to win over the court, I retort.
Nostrils flaring, General Yu seizes my throat. You are going to try, he snarls. And you are going to succeed. Or else your family, what pitiful part that's left of it, will be punished. Make no mistake, Kida.
He grasps my wrists and yanks them up to my face, fingers digging into my skin.
Their blood will be here. Do you understand me? On your hands.
His words chill me. I wrench away from him, shaking, as horror slinks in an ice-cold flood down my veins. Nausea knots my gut. The general laughs.
You think you're above this. I can see that. But believe me, girl, you are not. Because once you find out what happens to paper gone rotten, when you see what they do to whores who won't play along, you will beg the palace to keep you.
His eyes glide past me to the window.
We're here.
I whip round. Outside, willowy stalks of bamboo trees are flashing past, an ivory green blur. Eerie sounds fill the forest. The song of owls, rain dripping on leaves, distant calls from animals hidden in the dark. The air is loamy with the smell of wet earth. After hours of empty plains, the closeness of the trees startles me. We're passing through them impossibly fast, and even though there's a snap and sweep of leaves on the carriage's exterior, the noise is muffled. Yet more magic.
The great bamboo forest of Han, the general announces, and there's pride in his voice. Part of the palace's defenses. Too dense to enter on animal back. Too difficult for an army to traverse. It would take days to tear down a path. Visitors and traders must obtain the correct permits to be granted the dows from the royal shamans that open up this hidden road.
I watch the trees whip past, my eyes wide. After a few minutes, the carriage slows. The horses drop to a canter, then a trot, as the forest opens, and I reel back, eyes even wider than before. The Hidden Palace of Han. Fortress of the Demon King. Black rock as dark as night. Walls so high they eclipse the moon. The perimeter of the palace rears up from the earth, like some kind of giant stone monster. Far above, the tiny figures of guards pace the parapet. The walls have an unearthly shimmer about them, and as we draw closer, I notice millions of glowing characters ingrained in the marbled stone, swirling and spinning off one another beneath the rain-slicked surface. The low hum of chanting vibrates through the air. The royal shamans. Goosebumps prick across my skin. I've never felt magic like this.
"Shut your mouth," General Yu commands. "It's not womanly to stare."
I do as he says, too awed even to be insulted by his comment, as the carriage slows to a stop. There's a squelch of footsteps in the mud. Moments later, a rap on the wood makes me start. A round-faced, bear-form guard pulls aside the cover. Drops of rain nestling in the tufts of his brown fur.
"General Yu, back from Cienzo already," he bows. "I hope the heavens smiled upon your journey."
When he lifts his head, he blinks at me, ears twitching.
"If I may ask, General, who is your guest?"
"Lei Ji is here to join the court as a paper girl," the general replies with an impatient click of his tongue. "I sent two of my men ahead earlier to inform you. I assume you got the message. Or are we to be kept here waiting outside the palace, like a couple of lowly street peddlers?"
The guard dips his head. "Of course not, General. One moment. Let me confirm with Gatemaster Zhar." I watch out the window as a soldier, hunched against the rain, crosses to an outpost stationed behind a set of towering doors. The gates are set deep into the wall. To each side stand giant Pachalong, the statue sometimes placed outside buildings as protection from evil spirits. Most of the Pachalong in my village are small, just tokens, really, hand-sized, and easily torn from their plinths in a storm. These ones are enormous. They stand imposing at over 20 feet tall, carved in the likeness of bulls, their faces contorted into snarls that seem so real they snatch my breath away. Stone hands grip flame-lit braziers. As my eyes adjust to the light, I notice more statues lined along the wall. Then I start, because these guards are alive. The hairs on my arms stand up at the sight of hundreds of demons standing flank to flank along the perimeter of the palace. They stare fixedly ahead, swords crossed at their chests. The wet flicker of flames reflects in their eyes. Demon eyes. Gazelle, snow leopard, lion, boar. So many forms I've never seen before, and each one mooncast. Buffalo, wildcat, ibex, ape, cobra, jackal, tiger, rhinoceros. So many forms I've never even dreamed, and the thrum of barely contained strength in each glint of tapered incisor and horn and claw. I draw back, swallowing.
"Impressive, yes," the general states, but I don't give him the satisfaction of a reply. Or rather, I don't speak because I can't.
It's as though there were hands wrapped over my throat, as though the press of the demons were everywhere. At a way from the bear guard, a smaller set of doors beside the main gate draw open. The horses pull us through into a long tunnel. Its ceiling curves low, forming a cocoon of darkness. The chanting of the royal shamans echoes all around, a heavy hum in the air, the unsettling noise vibrating right down to my bones. Then everything goes silent. There's a flash like lightning. A fiery shiver explodes across my skin. I bite back a cry. The heat is just on the edge of bearable. I spin around, but can't see anything that might be causing it.
What's happening?
I stammer, rubbing my hands over my goose-pricked arms.
We're passing through the shaman's protection, General Yu answers. If we are not who we say we are, this Tao will reveal us to the guards inside. Only the most powerful shaman could weave magic to evade an enchantment like this. I would tell you that you get used to it, but it's not as if you'll ever be leaving.
The corners of his lips curve into sharp points.
Welcome to the palace, Paper Girl.
5. As we clear the tunnel, the sensation lifts, along with the uneasy silence. My first impression of the world within the palace grounds is a smell, so sweet it makes my mouth water. Night-blooming jasmine. The flowers burst in a fiery green tangle along the walls. The familiarity of the scent shocks me, and I take in my first look at the palace, gripping the edge of the bench as I lean forward to stare out, half holding my breath. We're in an enormous square. Braziers illuminate the vast space, shadows deep at its edges, empty except for a guard's pavilion and a row of stables. A couple of guards hurry over as our carriage comes to a stop. The general seems to know them well and greets them warmly, or at least what constitutes as warmth coming from him, before we continue on. Now that we're actually here, a strange sense of calm starts to take over me, like a blanket laid gently over something smoldering. I angle myself at the window, trying to get a better view, but the horses pick up the pace, and soon everything flies by in a blur. I catch only quick glimpses of my new home. Rain-slicked cobbles. The dark rush of gardens at night. Elegant temples with furled roofs. Their ornate architectural styles unfamiliar to me. We pass through small courtyards and wide open spaces. Linked squares with bridges arching over water. Grand, imposing structures crafted from marble. It stuns me how vast the palace is. Not just a palace, really, but a city. A labyrinth of streets, courtyards, and gardens. Like the veins and arteries flowing through a giant creature, with the king nestled at its core. Its own living, beating heart. I wonder if that heart is as black as I've been told. After 20 minutes, the horses finally slow.
This is it, General Yu announces as they draw to a halt.
He leans forward to tug aside the curtain at the front of the carriage.
Woman's court.
Massaging the numbness in my legs, I get to my feet and step out into rain and lantern-lit darkness. We're in what looks to be some kind of residential area. Tall walls enclose a web of streets comprised of interlocking houses and covered walkways set on raised platforms. The buildings are ornate, with dark walls of what looks like mahogany and rosewood, glossy under the downpour. Sliding bamboo screens, so delicate compared to the thick doors we have in Cienzo, reveal the backlit silhouettes of figures inside. Porches ring every house, lined with vases of white-petaled orchids and peonies. My feet slip in the muddy earth as a general leads me down one of the unlit paths at the base of the buildings. He keeps one hand on my shoulder to stop me from bolting. Though even if I knew where to run to, I'm not sure I could. My body seems bound to some unseen current as we move through the unfamiliar space. Everything cast in a dreamlike ruby haze from the red lanterns dangling from the curved eaves of buildings like ripe fruit. Rain dampens sounds drift out from open windows and doorways above. Female voices raised in laughter. Plucked zither music. Lilting and beautiful. We stop beside a servant's entrance, built into the side of a grand-looking house. The general pulls a rope, sounding a bell. A few seconds later, the door flies open. Light spills into the alley. A young girl of 10 or 11 blinks out at us. She has a gentle, moon-like face and round doe eyes, her hair pulled messily back into a lopsided bun. Loose strands unwind around her long, fluted ears. They are the only part of her that suggests she's not paper. She's a deer form. Steel, but barely. Lantern light glides across her smooth human skin, a mirror of mine, and an immediate sense of kinship rushes through me. After days in the sole company of demons, I want to hug her, press her soft, bare cheek to mine. "Oh," she cries, dropping to the floor in a low bow. "General, you." He barely looks at her. "Fetch Mistress Iara," he commands. The girl bounces to her feet at once, scuttling back inside the house. Her bun of hair bobs like a doe's stubbed tail, as though trying to help her appear more demon than she is. I peer after her. Past the doorway, a flight of stairs leads up to a lantern-lit corridor. Voices float down from the rooms beyond, and the air is warm, tea-scented. There's something so welcoming about the house that for a second, it's easy to imagine myself walking inside to find Tien and Baba and Bao. The pain is so sharp then that I have to dig my fingernails into my palms just to feel something else. This is not my home. Nowhere else ever will be. We've only been waiting a few minutes before the young girl reappears at the top of the steps, this time with a tall woman at her side. "Thank you, Lil," the woman says, and the girl scurries off. The paper woman turns to us. There's a pause as her eyes settle on me, and then she begins to make her way down the staircase. She moves impossibly lightly, a grace even to how she holds the hem of her plum-colored silk robes, the most exquisite I have seen in my life. They drape round her slim form effortlessly, patterned with silver embroidery, and held together at her waist by a wide band of fabric. It's this that jolts my memory to Tien, showing me drawings of one of our customers once gifted her. The simple ink illustrations reflected the styles of women's clothing favored by the central provinces. If I'm remembering correctly, these types of robes are a specific style of Hanfu, originally worn by the aristocracy of northeastern Shomu. At the bottom of the stairs, she bows. "General Yu." She stays just beyond the doorway, under the shelter of the house. Her jet-black eyes shine with intelligence, and a serene smile touches her lips. Instincts tell me that this woman was once a paper girl herself. Though she looks in her early 40s, the bronzed skin stretched over her high cheekbones is as smooth and poreless as a young girl's. The general inclines his head. "Mistress Iara, I apologize for coming to women's court and disturbing you without forewarning, but this matter couldn't wait." He pushes me forward. "May I present Lei Ji?" The woman's gaze flicks to me at his use of this suffix. She turns back to the general, a hint of something hard-edged in her smile. "How strange that you give her the paper girl title," she says, still smiling calmly. "The girls arrived a couple of hours ago. I was just entertaining them myself. Last time I checked,
All 8 were present.
I'm aware this is unusual, the general says quickly. But I hope you'll agree, it's for a worthy cause. When I found the girl and saw how striking her beauty was, I dropped everything to bring her to the palace.
I assure you, General, our girls are more than striking enough for the king. Folding her palms at her waist, Mistress Iara gives a short bow. Now I really must return. A bit too roughly, the general seizes my cheeks. He rests my face up so light from the stairwell catches my eyes. Gold upon gold. She was already half turning away, but in an instant, Mistress Iara freezes. Her lips part, and then she presses them firmly closed. Her eyes don't leave mine as she steps in close. Delicate perfume lifts from her skin. Rose water and the sweetly spiced scent of Neroli. I blink the water from my eyelashes, trying to keep my gaze steady as she regards me properly for the first time.
Heaven's blessings! Those eyes!
Mistress Iara glances at General Yu.
She really is pure paper?
I assure you, Mistress, her blood is human.
Her parents?
Herb shop owners from Western Sianzo.
So she has no experience with the court?
Unfortunately not, but she can learn fast. The girl is used to hard work. And look at how striking she is even now dressed so plainly. Imagine the transformation once you and Madame Himura have worked on her. Once she has been educated on the ways of women.
His tone turns silky.
And I'm sure you don't need me to remind you of our king's superstitious nature. Imagine how appreciative he might be to receive a girl who is as much a symbol of the heavens' good fortune as one of beauty. It could be the much-needed boost of confidence he needs, given everything we've been facing lately.
He trails off, and the two of them share a pointed look. The idea of the Demon King lacking confidence is so opposite to how I've been imagining him. I want to ask more about what things exactly the court has been facing lately, but Mistress Iara's focus pins me in place.
It's as if Allah herself smiled down from the heavens as you were born, she muses.
It's something I've heard before. Many people believe the moon goddess had a hand in coloring my eyes. Mistress Iara gives me a gentle smile.
Lei, she asks, are you sure you are ready for the life of a paper girl?
Behind her, the general's eyes fix on me. I remember his words in the carriage earlier.
Their blood will be here.
Do you understand me? On your hands.
Tian's face, my father's come to mind. The way they looked when the general thrust me into the carriage. The way they would look if I gave him reason to act out his threat. Tears prick my eyes. I force out this gruesome image and instead picture them smiling, working, laughing, living. There is only one answer I can give if I want that for them, and so I offer it, even though it breaks my heart, pushing the word from my tongue like a stone.
Yes.
I knew it even earlier, at the dock in Noi, and on the boat to Han, and maybe even before then, from the minute General Yu's eyes met mine in the shop. It was pointless to hope for a different outcome. And even though it's the slimmest of chances, at least being here in the palace means I might find out what happened to my mother.
Still,
The word leaves a bitter flavor in my mouth. It tastes like failure. Like betrayal. I swallow it down as Mistress Iara smiles, draping an arm across my back.
Thank you, General, she tells him. You were right to bring Lei here. I'll introduce her to Madame Himura right away. Hopefully her reaction will be as positive as mine. We'll be sure to make it known to the king that Lei comes as your personal gift.
Bowing one last time, she ushers me into the house. Before she shuts the door, I look back at the general. His smirk is wider than I've seen it, his eyes bright with triumph. Mistress Iara leads me to a small windowless room and asks me to wait, leaving me standing awkwardly in the middle of the floor. Water drips from my soaked clothes onto the polished teak boards. I smooth my hands over my matted hair, trying and failing to slow my heart. Even after the long journey here, it doesn't feel real. I'm in the royal palace. In one of its buildings, the king is waiting. I don't know when I'll be introduced to him. The horror hits me that it could be tonight. And the palace is so vast, he's not likely to be close by. Still, there's something intimate about it. To be inside the palace walls. Perhaps even in a building he's been in once before. My spine tingles. Hugging my arms, I glance over my shoulder with a ridiculous notion that he could even be standing behind me. The next time steps sound in the corridor, hard clicks accompany the light footfall of Mistress Iara. A strange, hunched shadow appears behind the sliding door. It's not quite human, too bulky in the shoulders and neck. Instinctively, I back away, readying myself. But I can't help the curl of fear as the door opens and the woman I assume to be Madame Himura enters the room. Only, she isn't just a woman. She is a demon. An eagle demon. Eagle forms are one of the rarest kinds of demon. Like a lot of bird forms, many lost their lives fighting in the Night War, and they've been mostly recruited since as soldiers for the king's army. I've never seen a bird form up close before, apart from the quick glimpse of the swan girl on the road out of the Black Port. The first thing I notice are her eyes, two hooded crescents of yellow. Their piercing gaze cuts straight through me. Pearl-white feathers flow down to a hooked beak that pulls her humanoid jaw out of place. So her face is at once familiar, but extremely not. Graphite robes set off the inky plumage that sheathes her body.
So, she says, glaring at me, this is what all the fuss is about?
Her voice is hoarse, a croak that seems to come from the back of her throat. She steps closer, revealing the glint of scaled claws from beneath her robes. A taloned hand at the end of one arm, human limbs melded with eagle feathers, clutches the handle of a bone walking stick. But despite the hunched-over way she moves, there's still power there, brimming energy.
Your age, girl,
she snaps brusquely, making me jump. I wet my lips. 17.
When were you born?
The first day of the new year.
An auspicious sign, she muses. And the moon would have been golden then. Perhaps that is what lent you those eyes.
Well, I say, my cheeks hot. It wasn't a demon. Madame Himura bristles at this, the sleek feathers coating her arms ruffle
seeming to blur her arms into wings as they fan out before settling back against her skin.
Anyone with half a brain can tell you're